Finding great candidates to hire can be like, well, trying to find a needle in a haystack. Sure, you can post your job to some job board, but then all you can do is hope the right person comes along. Which is why you should try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its powerful technology identifies people with the right experience and actively invites them to apply to your job. You get qualified candidates fast. So while other companies might deliver a lot of hay, ZipRecruiter finds you what you're looking for. The needle in the haystack.
See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free, at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. That's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Positively Trek. This one's a doozy, folks. I've been really looking forward to chatting about it. Dan, how you feeling today?
Oh, I'm doing okay if this internet of mine doesn't stop acting up.
I tell ya, you know, we're having internet from the 1950s right now, folks, I have to say. So if things get a little pixelated on the video, you know, just pretend that there's a bunch of like spinning discs whirling around and weird inexplicable lights going off on big boards and
ooh,
stuff like
spinning
that.
Discs. Do we have to try and maneuver them into these weird funnels and then get like, you know, feelings that we can't really describe when we do it?
Well, that's another, I suppose, retro Star Trek aspect as well of it. A lot of people, I think, spend their time with those spinning discs and stuff like that. I know I've been playing a little too much online gaming over the last little while. Just I've had a bit more free time on my hands and I got stuck in on a game and I'm really not good at it, Dan. I'm a terrible online gamer. I'm really bad at it, and I'm probably going to stop.
Well, it's got to keep giving you those dopamine hits to keep you going, though. So,
and I'm not getting any. I'm getting more and more frustrated. So, yes, I wouldn't have succumbed to the game, I suppose, as much as others. Well, this episode, I have to say. Oh, and I'm Barry, by the way. Sorry, I don't think I ended up saying that. This episode, I've been really looking forward to, Dan, mainly because I feel very much like it has a level of irreverence that, personally, I always really enjoy. There's always an aspect of a television show, especially, you know, in its modern iterations, not taking itself seriously. And I think, to some degree, the ethos of Positively Trek lends itself to that a little bit. So I really feel like this this is sort of a kindred spirit to the podcast itself that we run here. I mean, you and I can be very heartfelt from time to time, but I also feel like we can enjoy a certain amount of irreverence. So yeah. Kind of moving into this, that's the tone I want to take.
Yeah, and to that, to your point there, it's an interesting episode, and we'll get into this later for sure. It has this tone of irreverence, but it kind of morphs into a surprising reverence a little bit, and I kind of love that. And yeah, we'll get into it for sure. But this is one, and we're recording this just to give a little bit of context. The first 2 episodes of the season just dropped last night as we're recording this. So we're a couple weeks ahead here, and I'm really curious what the general reaction to this episode is going to be. I have no idea. It could really go either way, I think. And I'm really curious to see what everyone else thinks, but yeah. It's they're riding a bit of a knife's edge here, and I kind of dig it.
Yeah, this episode actually takes a ton of risks, and I think that's useful and good. I think you and I have had hit and miss responses to some of the Trek stuff when it comes out, and we've got a couple of weeks before it actually comes out. You know, having the screener privileges, dear listener and viewer, it also kind of runs things on a razor edge, because you know we're putting our flag down on how we feel about an episode long before all of the critics and the rest of the audience does. So always know we are being 100% honest. We're not looking at what other people have to say. These are personal responses by yours truly and Dan. And I think that's really important. So take this. So when the episode itself does drop, late July, early August, I believe.
Yeah, I think the very last day in July is when this one.
Okay.
And then our episode should be the next day after that.
Perfect. So yeah, this is an advance. And so understand that this is us looking at this from a very honest and personal perspective. And, you know, where you'd mentioned that there's a reverence, I would say that this episode is irreverently reverent mm-hmm. in its approach. And you're
writing
right.
that down as a title, by the way.
Sure. I think, yeah, it could rub some people, especially former Star Trek stars, the wrong way. But I really hope that you're coming from this episode having watched it and maybe feeling similar to us, that you might start by looking at this and being like, wow, they're really taking some jabs here. But in the end, this baby wraps up in a pretty wonderful way, and there are some very interesting aspects. So the episode we're talking about is Star Trek Strange New Worlds, Season 3, Episode 4, A Space Adventure Hour, written by Diana Horgan and Catherine Lynn, and directed by Jonathan freaking Frakes, everybody.
And just in case we miss mentioning this later in the episode, there's an actual audio cameo by Jonathan Frakes in this episode. During one of the scenes, you can hear him directing the 50s, 60s sci-fi pastiche. No, keep rolling. You just hear his voice faintly in the background. That was wonderful. I kept wanting him on screen, but yeah. Alas, just his voice. But that was still really cool.
Well, you picked that one out too. And again, Dan, you've got the ears of a hawk. How do we say that?
I know my Star Trek stars. That's
you certainly do. Yeah, no. And again, I think you know, looking, you know, Diana Horgan, Catherine Lynn, and good old Johnny Frakes, as he'd be known as in those days, I'm sure in the 50s. This episode was well crafted, well produced, and I think maybe just starting. Let's talk a bit about this cold open. And you're in the notes, Dan. You actually wrote it's a 50s sci-fi parody. And those of you who have seen this episode, if you haven't seen this episode, please stop listening and go watch it. You'll enjoy this. Even if you're like a casual Star Trek fan, get them in on this because they would like this too. It does a lot of what I think, you know, shows like The Big Bang Theory does. It tries to paint Star Trek in this picture that isn't actually real. You were very clever to point out that actually Star Trek is more how we talk about it, and other podcasters talk about Star Trek in its visions of understanding the human condition, understanding, you know, ripped from the headlines kind of ideas, talking about technology, our relationships with one another, what is intelligence. I could go on. This cold open is a lot more of that swashbuckling, stylized, very misogynistic 50s version of science fiction.
Very much what, like, Gene Roddenberry had said Star Trek was trying to argue against, right?
Exactly.
Lost in Space. It wasn't that, you know, Buck Rogers. It wasn't that sort of thing. It was meant to elevate the form, right? So I feel like this maybe cold open might turn a lot of people off, and this is where I'm kind of wondering what the general reaction is. Folks, watch the whole episode. It's playing into, as you say, kind of the popular perception of what old Star Trek was. You know, rubber rocks, people in big rubber suits, and like that kind of overacting and all of that stuff. If you peel back that layer, Star Trek was a lot more than that. But this is definitely playing on those popular perceptions.
And, yeah.
You know, you'll enjoy it or you won't, basically. Yeah.
But I think where I really enjoyed it and what I liked, because, I mean, you and I were able to clock what they were trying to do pretty fast, I would say. And again, this isn't a job for us. This is a hobby. But because we do a lot of this, I think it was easy for us to recognize what they were getting at as the set designers. And I have to say, this set was meticulously put together in a way that actually I found a little surprising. They have, like I'd said, you know, they've got the spinning reels, like would have been in the late 50s, early 60s. They had those sort of inexplicable blinking lights. Like I remember, you know, watching different science fiction shows, usually through the lens of Mystery Science Theater 3000. A lot of what I recognized was there. Like it felt like this could have been the spaceship on this island Earth, or you know, something along those lines. It's very clear to me that the set designers really did their homework on this one, and that's going to keep coming up, both in regard to the set designers, in regard to the producers, the writers, and the directors. You can really tell that they went into the source material that they were trying to draw from in a very intentional way. So the colors, you know, imagine watching this one, you know, if say you didn't have a color television, right? Mm-hmm. The way those colors would present on a black and white TV, I think would be really fascinating. I might have mentioned this in the past, but my mom's house in the late 50s, early, I guess it would have been the early 60s, my grandpa won a television in a raffle, a color television. And so his was the first color television on the block in like northwestern Edmonton. And so people would come from all around to watch the Ed Sullivan Show and I think Bonanza, and then eventually Star Trek, because those were the only shows in color. Mm-hmm. And so kids from like, my mom was like, kids we didn't even know would like show up asking to come and watch the color TV at the start. I mean, obviously everything loses its luster, but I remember my grandpa, I think it actually was my grandma telling me that when she first started watching color TV shows, she was always like, I really felt like the colors were over the top, that they were almost like, we're in color now. And it was very like loud and like, mm-hmm. I don't know. I also felt like, you know, the bridge that they created on this show, The Last Frontier, you could have played a game of mini golf on it, right? I felt like it was kind of like lit by black light and had a lot of very sort of aggressive colors to it. But yeah, that's kind of my long-winded chatter love letter to the set designers. This was a very meticulously put together set.
Yeah, and meticulously put together in such a way that it looks like it's cheap and... like I appreciated that at the one part where they're like doing the fake shaking thing, and during the course of that, and I kind of had to think about like the process involved in this. During that, one of the levers like bounces around and falls off the console, and I'm like, wait a minute, they're not actually shaking the set. Like that was designed to do that as the camera was shaking to make it look cheaper, but like the mechanism or how they managed to do that, whether it was just the actor knocked it and I didn't notice or there was actually some mechanism to do that, that's pretty complicated.
Right?
Like that was great. And yeah, the little visual gag of the cheapness of the set mm-hmm. kind of falls apart when you realize it's not actually shaking. There's no reason it would like be loosed from its housing because the set's shaking. That's not happening.
Yeah.
But it was clever. It was a clever little sight gag.
Yeah, so much clever sight gag. You know, open the door, right? Like they're not pulling the string fast enough, and all that sort of stuff. I'm still trying to figure out who the actor was in that alien costume.
Yeah, I at one point thought it was Rebecca Romijn, but same. Then I wasn't sure after that. So yeah, it was a woman, I believe.
Yes,
or the voice was female coded for sure. But yeah, I was like, is that Rebecca Romijn or someone else? And I'm not sure. I kind of almost hope it was a regular like double or background actor who actually got to get some lines and a little extra paycheck that week. That would make me happy.
That would, but it would also kind of make me happy if Rebecca Romijn had to endure all of that crazy makeup, because what a crab. I loved how like upset that character was portrayed in their like weird outfit. Yeah. So speaking of actors, let's talk a little bit about what I would say I really appreciate the range that we get from these actors. Again, I'd mentioned the meticulousness of the set designers, the source material that the writers drew from, the way in which Frakes directed this. But I mean, part of the ensemble, part of this team is the actors. And I have to say, I had waxed lyrical already about this cast. This is one of the reasons. They have an extremely strong range, and they work so well as an ensemble. They draw off of each other. You could feel the energy. I love watching TV or movies where it's very clear the actors are having fun. And watching them have fun gives me so much more investment in the story. So let's start with TK Bellows, the creator of the final or the Last Frontier. Anson Mount plays the stand-in for Gene Roddenberry, but not really Gene Roddenberry. I really feel like they sidestepped him quite a bit, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, they definitely, with maybe one exception, don't do one-to-one of real-life people. And yeah, this was interesting. I have a lot to say about kind of what this episode is saying about Star Trek as well through this character. Mm-hmm. But yeah, he plays TK Bellows, the creator and head writer of The Last Frontier, like you said. And over the course of this episode, getting more and more drunk, basically, which I feel like was a lot of fun for him to play. And he's just off his rocker. Yeah. And I noted partway through that I he may be a little bit more Isaac Asimov than Gene Roddenberry, just based on what I've seen of him. Not the getting drunk or anything like that, but just a little bit in the way the character looks, and a little bit in the way that he acts with other people and stuff. Felt a little bit Isaac Asimov. And if you want to see, I can't think of a lot of Isaac Asimov examples that you can quickly look up, but another really good one where they were absolutely channeling Isaac Asimov would be Cole Meany playing the writer in Far Beyond the Stars. That was very much an Isaac Asimov spoof. And you'll note a lot of similarities between his performance and Anson Mount's performance here.
Yeah, I would say an Isaac Asimov meets Andy Warhol.
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely. Good call.
Yeah, I was struggling to find his name there. So, but yeah, no, it's a grand departure as well from the type of character that Mount plays, right? Normally.
I've noticed that I think he likes to do this. Like, if you think back to season one, or at least the writers like having him do this or something. In season one, the Elysian Kingdom, right? He played the kind of nebbish, duplicitous turncoat character, right? And he was very, you know, slimy and very un-Captain Pike, right?
Yeah.
And then same here, very un-Captain Pike. He's very, he talks very quietly in kind of this bit of a lilting voice and is just not the commanding presence that Pike is. So
he likes to mince. He likes to just mince around.
Yeah, it's really fun to see.
It's also fun watching him hold a gun and a drink at the same time. That was, So yeah, there's more to talk about TK Bellows. So I'm actually gonna jump a little bit. I want to, just looking, we have a script rerun off, folks, and I'm going to jump the next character because I feel like a lot needs to be said there, and I don't want to get stuck in the reeds of that one. So we've got Jess Bush as Adelaide Shaw, who plays the first female officer. What do you have to say about this one overall, would you say?
Well, it's funny because they're also not only playing the actor, they're playing the actor playing the character. So her line readings as the first officer of the USS Adventure are fun. But Captain, blah, 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 like very straight, you know, adventure kind of sounding. But then as herself outside of the production, she actually gets to use her own Native Australian accent. I love that. That's that was fun.
I like it because she really does come off as a fish out of water, right? Obviously, in the 1960s with Star Trek, we see leading ladies, right? Majel Barrett, Nichelle Nichols, just to name two to start, right? Who have prominent roles in an otherwise male and white male dominated genre of television. So I like how when she's the actor playing the character in it, in Space Adventure Hour or Last Frontier, she really does have that kind of like high-shouldered, I don't actually know what I'm doing here, I'm probably still super objectified off-screen kind of way about her.
You know who she reminded me of? I'm just realizing this now, is Yeoman Colt from the original Cage.
Oh, wow.
Captain, yeah. Blah, blah, like just, the, yeah.
Holy crap. Good catch. Yeah,
that's absolutely. That's really interesting.
I would imagine Bush probably use that, thinking about it. Yeah, there is a lot of like center of the screen turn, but captain, right?
Yeah, that the inflection sort of on her voice, it sounds like a one-to-one. Like,
yeah, absolutely. Wow. I do appreciate hearing the actual accent that she has. I can't say I've like heard it much in the past. And convincing. Her American accent is actually pretty strong. I appreciate it very much. And accents do some changing around here. And I sometimes on the fly, which I really do enjoy. So let's talk a little bit about Melissa Navia as Lee Woods, the doctor, and just the general frustration that she sort of exhibits throughout this entire story.
Yeah. So yeah, when we see her in character as the doctor, and she's just credited in the opening credits as the doctor, she doesn't have much. She's kind of got a gruff aspect to her voice. I think she was channeling a little bit of DeForest Kelly, Bones McCoy there.
Yeah.
A bit. My favorite though is when we see her as Lee Woods, the actor, during the whole murder mystery thing. And she's kind of almost the same, a little bit gruff, a little rough around the edges. And she has one of the best lines of the episode, I think, where, you know, someone has died and they're like, what's wrong with her? What's happened? And she says, you know, I'm an actor, not a doctor, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Very nice. The other thing I want to comment on, and I recently, as I mentioned in a previous episode, heard an interview with Melissa Navia, and her hair in this episode came up. And apparently, like, the first trailer dropped, and her mom, I think it was, called her up and said, what is with your hair this season? And she's like, that's just, it's for a thing. I can't really explain it. It's not, it's a thing. I don't know. Long hair? No. Yeah.
Well, I really think they kind of captured the 60s style really well, that kind of blend between how different people would be dressing at about that time. And I feel like her actor that she plays, the Lee Woods actor, would like fit in really well hanging out with kind of Bruce Lee's crowd to some degree. You know, the leather jacket, kind of looking cool, you know, from that part of LA, you know, Pasadena sort of area. I really do appreciate her general kind of like frustrated, I'm not really a part of this, I'm actually just simply getting a paycheck for this, and everybody taking themselves so seriously is kind of annoying, right? I really feel like she bounced off of other characters' self-importance really well, with a kind of like, oh my god, like, this is dumb, why are we here, why am I having to deal with these idiots kind of feel, which I really appreciate. I liked that, and she carries that kind of energy extremely well. So as that, we've also got Babs with a speaking role. I don't think he says more than
he's got a bit, like, he gets interviewed by the
later on, yes.
Yeah.
But he does kind of just sort of exist on the periphery of this cast. But he does a really good job of, again, just kind of being a Hollywood person, in a Hollywood place, like you would see in the 1960s. You know, again, very, very much someone I think would hang out in kind of Bruce Lee's LA crowd, right? Like, I could see him, you know, maybe even channeling the Black Panther vibe a little bit to some degree, or the Black Power vibe, which was, you know, obviously growing quite a bit in the 1960s. And I appreciate that quite a bit.
Yeah. But also, like, illustrating the weirdness of Hollywood in that he's helping, I think, Lee Woods write a Western script or something.
Yes. Yes.
I just love how, like, the weird swings that Hollywood takes, that, like, you know, someone who you would never expect is working on a Western script, I guess. And
yeah.
Okay.
But I mean, I love, you know, that's kind of where things went, right? I mean, if you think about the TV show Kung Fu, right? It was a it was a martial arts western. Like a lot of risks were taken in the 60s and the late 50s in terms of television. A lot more than the risks that get taken today, obviously. Then we've complained about that quite a bit. So moving next on, we've got our Lucille Ball character, I feel, yes. Right? We've got Rebecca Romijn as Sunny Lupino, and her husband gets offed pretty fast, which I also feel, you know, Desi kind of gets that to some degree in the storytelling. I think he didn't really treat Lucille Ball very well, from what I understand, they off him. Immediately, he doesn't even get a moment to even speak for himself. But to some degree, I don't necessarily feel bad about that, just given what I understand the actual man did to Lucille Ball. So that's an interesting kind of connection there. But Rebecca Romijn does a good job, and I feel like she kind of channeled a little Arrested Development Lucille to some degree. Would you say?
I could see that. Yeah. Her death scene especially, I think, was the holodeck having a little bit of fun there.
Yeah.
But yeah, I really appreciate this character. I'm kind of sad we don't get more time with her, but definite, yeah, Lucille Ball vibes there. You know, the person who pushed for Star Trek, or sorry, The Last Frontier, my bad, with her husband co-producer kind of thing. Interesting commentary there, I think, which I appreciated. I like that.
Well, and I think, again, this episode does a lot to underscore how much women played a role in the stewardship of the series as it got started, right? And in real life, obviously, an extremely fundamental role to play, and you know, non-white women too. And so looking at Celia Rose Gooding as the talent agent, I really have to say her costuming was fantastic in this. Like, wow, like a lot of range and stuff like that, but they really did her up well, and I have to say that 1960s style really fits her. Again, I feel very much like as the talent agent, you again get to kind of get a glimpse at that kind of murky aspect of 1960s Hollywood in a characterized sort of sense, right? She is that interlocutor between the cast and the writers and everyone else, and people who really are just interested in the bottom line. And I don't think that's something that's changed. And maybe using TK Bellows as another aspect of that, when we talk about him a little more in depth, I feel like there's a commentary being made also by the writers here, but I'm going to get into that a little bit later as well.
Celia Rose Gooding's character as the talent agent. I really appreciated her performance here with as the starry-eyed Star Trek fan, basically, at one point. But one thing I also really liked was this is a television show in 2025. She's continually trying to find a light for her cigarette, but can't. Yes. Because they don't want to show somebody smoking. I love that.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
That was fun.
Well, and she also does a good job at maybe speaking on behalf of the writers, right? Kind of where I was getting at there is that she is kind of the fourth wall breaker a little bit. And that, you know, I forget the exact, I don't have the quote, but there is a point where the way she talks about this fictionalized television show kind of blends out into what I think the writers are trying to say to us in a lot of ways. So she does a really good job of making that connection. And yeah, looking for the lighter shows she's kind of a future person in this past setting. So we've left this one for the last, but Paul Wesley plays Maxwell Saint. Yes. And I feel like Bill Shatner might be a little upset.
I don't know. Bill Shatner plays the parody version of William Shatner enough that, I don't know, I think he'd appreciate it.
I hope so.
The one thing I will say is it's so obvious to me that, you know, Paul Wesley kind of came in with this idea to do this. And I bet you no matter what he did, Jonathan Frakes as the director was there going, more, give me more, give me more. Because this is pushed to the absolute nth degree. And I mean, like, the number of times I've watched that scene where he's like, don't lecture me on space jurisdiction. I'm known for my diction. Just like, oh my God. It's so bad, but it's, or they, so
like,
good.
They like zoom in on his eyes and like the light comes on.
The light so changes. Just, yeah.
Like, oh my goodness. But even like off, like his off screen, you know, Maxwell Saint is as well just an insufferable prick, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, playboy, just bleh. Yeah,
you know, very, very self-involved, very, you know, he is a legend in his own mind, like he knows that like this is a masterpiece because of me, you know. Mm-hmm. But then he spends so much time bumbling around the set, like later he gets stuck in the chair or he like breaks the chair down and stuff like that, like
trying to swing his leg over it, a la Riker.
Exactly. Does the Riker maneuver and just takes it out. No, I do have to say that Paul Wesley, as a person who is reinventing Kirk in a lot of ways, and in a really good way, I do very much quite appreciate his Kirk. In fact, to the point that it might now be my favorite Kirk. and maybe that's just because it's the most recent one, and maybe I'll change if we do another iteration later or something. But I do have to say his iteration of Kirk is fantastic, and his iteration of a pastiche of Bill Shatner as Kirk was fantastic. It was, yeah, I agree with you that he would be seeing, or that Jonathan Frakes would be wanting more and more. But also, I mean, Frakes kind of played the next generation of Kirk in TNG originally, but obviously with a lot more seriousness kind of put into the character. So who better to also kind of get his little take on Kirk than Jonathan Frakes himself as the director?
And I will say, like, we now know that Paul Wesley can do Shatner's Kirk if he so chose, right? No, he brings his own to Kirk. But, you know, if you really wanted him to, he could. But no thanks.
Warning, the following ZipRecruiter radio spot you are about to hear is going to be filled with F-words.
When you're hiring, we at ZipRecruiter know you can feel frustrated, forlorn even, like your efforts are futile. And you can spend a fortune trying to find fabulous people, only to get flooded with candidates who are just fine. Fortunately, ZipRecruiter figured out how to fix all that. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. With ZipRecruiter, you can forget your frustrations because we find the right people for your roles fast, which is our absolute favorite F word. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day.
Fantastic.
So, whether you need to hire 4, 40, or 400 people, get ready to meet first-rate talent. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/zip to try ZipRecruiter for free. Don't forget, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. Finally, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
As always, Positively Trek is brought to you by its Patreon supporters, including Joyce Mirren, Brandy Jackala, Christina DeClercq-Zalagi, John Guppy, Out of Memory, Patrick Carlin, and Ricky Long. If you'd like to support the podcast, visit patreon.com/positivelytrek. You can join at any level and enjoy early access to episodes, ad-free episodes, episode shoutouts, executive producer credits, and more. Again, that's patreon.com/positivelytrek. Thank you so much to those of you supporting us. We truly do appreciate it. And now, back to the show.
So that's the range of sort of this fictional ensemble within that. But now I think we can start talking a bit about the character development within this as well, because as much as this is sort of, like we said, like an irreverently reverent take on Star Trek and sci-fi in the 60s, I think we also get some pretty strong character development, especially around Lon and Scotty specifically. Mm-hmm. So starting with Lon, one thing that you know, that we've talked about is how much she's opening up, right? She's kind of come through a lot. And I mean, I would argue that that has something to do with, and Dan, you'd mentioned this, right? Like, now that she's kind of faced the Gorn, she can kind of put that in the past a little bit more. She can kind of move beyond it. And I think that was a really good point you brought up. But I think to start, what I really liked was when she got to go into this holodeck session, she almost had a like a childlike enjoyment because she was reading those novels that kind of based itself off of the murder mystery that was being created by the holodeck. And watching her enjoy kind of playing dress up is something that I can really really kind of connect to myself. Like I love dressing up in my fandom stuff. And so seeing her do that with like the smoky eyes and that again 1960s kind of feel with the preposterous but also workable hat. I really, really enjoyed it. She kind of gave me like Carmen Sandiego vibes to some degree.
Yeah, it's so much fun to see her cut loose a little bit. And I don't think that's subtext. I think that's text that you know, having pushed through this Gorn stuff, it's really allowed her to come out on the other side. Like we saw a brief glimpse of a possible future for her at the end of season one of Strange New Worlds. And she was bright and smiling and gave Pike a hug. And Pike was like, what is happening? And we're seeing that. We're seeing her blossom into that. And I'm here for it. I love... we mentioned in a previous episode, her personality type that I've seen her in interviews and stuff is much closer to the really bubbly, over the top, joyous type person. And I'm look forward to seeing shades of that in Lon. And I think we're getting a little bit of that here. I really, really enjoy that.
If I was to make a prediction, I do feel like that darker edge will reveal itself again or have to be sort of revisited in the future. Obviously, I think the writers are kind of setting us up for that, but getting
a deep part of her for sure.
Absolutely.
Like it's not. Yeah.
It could go a couple of different ways. And obviously we don't know Lon's fate, right? I guess ultimately. So in this respect, I think that we're getting more textures to these actors and they get to do whatever they want with Lon. And I think that that by sort of exploring this other level of her, again, it exhibits the range that the actor has. I mean, again, I like the fact that she throws a very strong North American accent as well. I'm quite impressed by it. But also the change feels earned, I guess is the best way to put it, is watching her develop over the last few seasons. None of this feels like she just sort of like flipped a switch. You can really follow the trail of rice. And I think that creates a lot more investment in the character in a way that doesn't always happen in modern serialization, modern kind of episodic television. So even though each we have episodic style of this series, we still see this very kind of like through line of character development. I think we would be remiss also to not bring up kind of how this episode ends, right? With the fact that she and Spock have been confiding in each other, that they've been opening up quite a bit. And as much as this was an irreverent and kind of fun, quirky episode, what do you think about that kiss in the end?
Oh boy. There was some heat to it, and I'm like, man, Spock's a player, right? I wasn't expecting this, but
yeah.
I like that it's not out of left field. It's not. I mean, it's a bit of a surprising moment for sure, but when it happens, you kind of put all the pieces together from the last few episodes, right? Of the times they've spent together, working on. You know, Spock's dancing and all of this. He's replaced his morning calisthenics routine with dance training, and she's taken part in that a lot. It's a lot of fun. It's interesting, and I'm curious to see where this goes.
Yeah,
unexpected but not surprising, I guess.
And again, I don't think unearned. Right, I feel like absolutely. They did as they sort of physically interact with each other through the dance. And I mean, some of the dancing they've been doing, whoof-da. At the same time, though, I feel like Spock has really opened up to Lon. And I feel like Lon has been a really good sort of lighthouse for him in his moments of turmoil and frustration and uncertainty. So again, I'm not surprised that the two of them have actually found that by confiding in each other, they actually kind of might like one another. And that kiss really does, it sets things in motion. Like, here we are chuckling and laughing and being like, oh, wow, you know, like, what a cool love story to Star Trek this. And then they, bam, hit you with this thing that makes you be like, okay, I got to watch the next episode. This has to happen now, right? So again, yeah. Lon, and then solving this case, I feel like, again, her knowing Spock has a lot to do with that. But I think we'll get to the solution of this case a little bit later, but I'll kind of put a pin in that for now. Scotty, not quite knowing exactly what he's doing, but I liked kind of how you had mentioned the way Scotty is handling things.
Yeah, so Scotty, not quite the miracle worker that we know him to be yet. And again, there's a little bit of Una character stuff here that links back to a previous episode where we talked about her as well. I love that in the course of this episode, Scotty is going it alone and taking on all these challenges himself and refusing help, basically. And at the end of the episode, when all said and done, the crisis is past, Una calls him out on it and says, you know, there are 203 people on this ship. And they're all very qualified. There's no reason you had to be in there dealing with that yourself. You can ask for help. And he's not a team player yet. He feels like he has to go it alone because of what happened with the Star Diver and the loss of his crew there. And he feels like that's all on him. And he needs to assume that burden and not endanger or bring other people in, right? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's interesting. I'm looking forward to more development on Scotty over the next, hopefully, 3 seasons, I guess. He's a, such a fascinating character and was always one of my absolute favorites in TOS. So to see, you know, the beginnings here, I think is a lot of fun.
Yeah, and I think there's a reminiscence and maybe a through line that we can draw with the entire storytelling of this season of people trying to do things on their own or on their own volition, being very single-minded when really that's not a good idea, right? I'm reminded of Ortegas's maneuver in the last episode, right? She really shouldn't have taken matters into her own hands because, of course, Pike and M'Benga would have gotten off that planet anyways, right? She did actually endanger the crew. And I think Una is again, kind of showing a bit of a through line that she does actually have what it takes to be that voice of reason in command and to remind everybody that we're a team, we're a crew, we're together in all of this. We do things single-mindedly and on our own without, you know, the input and assistance from other people, we're not going to make it very far. You know, I was actually talking about this, you know, kind of taking this into our society. You know, you and I live in a heavy resource extraction part of the world where a lot of people work, especially in oil and gas. And I have a friend who has been working quite a bit in that realm. And he very much says, like, there's so many people who try to do things on their own by themselves without any other assistance. And he's like, and that's how people lose fingers and get hurt and, you know, mess things up because they get angry and, oh, I'll just do it myself. And then it typically ends in disaster. Like we have to understand that error is part of learning, first of all. And I see Scotty making errors in this. I really appreciate how through these errors and missteps, he is solving the problem, but he's never going to be able to totally do it alone. Now, obviously, this has a lot to do with his PTSD too, right? What happens on the Star Diver, you know, it would make me kind of rethink how, you know, if I just do it, it would be easier kind of thing. But we have to kind of let go of that and work as a team and understand that, you know, by doing things just yourself, you know, you isolate and you atomize. I mean, you and I come from the education profession. And again, there's a lot of teachers, I think, who just kind of do things alone and that can really wipe you out. So Scotty is also not only a great character development in this, I think he's a very strong lens on the hyper-individualism that we see in our society today. And it started in the 60s, right? There is a lot of the don't tell me what to do, I'll do it myself kind of feel to things. Now, his comes definitely from a state of fear and sorrow and trauma, but it comes from a lot of different places.
Yeah, you made a good point about the individualistic nature, especially like coming out of the 60s and stuff. I never really thought of it through that lens, but I like that this show kind of becomes a bit of a commentary on that. And I think, you know, we're big on Star Trek and its social messaging, and that's part of the messaging that I think is easy to overlook, the little things like that. But in much the same way that watching TNG growing up, right? I got little lessons about what it's like to work in a team, to work as part of a group. And I feel like this is yet another generation that maybe needs a bit of that lesson, right? Mm-hmm. So, that's cool. I like that.
Star Trek exploring the human condition. Who would have thought?
Yeah, right? Weird, bizarre. All this and a weekly space adventure?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So how this all plays out, right? The solution to the holodeck mystery. Who is the killer? And the fact that the holodeck, it's said in this episode that it's going to kind of read the player, right? Who in this case is Lon. It's going to read her and sort of devise a solution that she'll be able to figure out, but it's not going to be kind of an easy one, and it's going to kind of hybridize itself as it goes. How did you feel about how this murder mystery kind of plays out?
Well, I have to say it was clever in that, like, I didn't see the ultimate solution to the mystery coming. In retrospect, and actually, I know you haven't had an opportunity to watch this episode a second time, but watch this episode a second time. For example, during the interrogation scene of Paul Wesley's character, they're sitting there interrogating him, and Spock says, "Did you murder so-and-so?" And he's like, "No, did you?" Like all of these little foreshadowing bits, and there's a bunch of them, and I'm like, oh, interesting. So I love foreshadowing in these pieces of media, that especially when you rewatch it. But yeah, okay, so the fact that the holographic Spock was never there from the very beginning, it turns out that he's the killer. And we have shades of Elementary Dear Data here, right? Where Geordi says to the computer, create an adversary capable of defeating Data, which gives rise to Moriarty, right? Yeah. Lon here says, create a mystery that I would have a difficult time solving. I as Lon Noonien Singh, not the character, right? And the computer says, okay, here's the typical thing for this mystery. Here's a solution you're never going to see coming. And it kind of breaks its own rules to do it a little bit. I love that. I thought that was great. And and the way that she comes to that realization was wonderful too. I make no claim of seeing that ending coming. It totally surprised me moments before the reveal. I was like, oh, wait a minute. But throughout the episode, I did kind of notice that Spock was acting far more detached and emotionless than usual. Like there was something Lon said and he just kind of like looked through her almost. Mm-hmm. And I was like, wow, this is almost like later Spock. Like this is a very different Spock than what we've been seeing. And I didn't realize literally he's a very different Spock to the one we've been seeing. So yeah. Very clever of the writers, very great acting by Ethan Peck as well. So like everybody in this episode plays a different version of themselves, including Ethan Peck, even though he looks, walks and talks and acts just like our Spock.
Absolutely. That's well put. And I think that, they use, was it the transporter codes for the individuals to kind of create
the patterns? Yeah. Because they're the highest resolution. The computer won't have to make up people from scratch. Presumably they'd all look kind of waxy and weird and have extra fingers if the computer just made it up.
Right. So to kind of bring this into the solution itself, I mean, this really reminds me of a lot of my interactions with AI, right? Mm-hmm. The solution itself appears to be something of a moving target, right? And as it settles itself on Spock, at least from a first watch, it does feel like it's a moving target. Like it really could have initially chosen someone else as the killer, but as Lon's character is building a case, I think it starts, like, once she pulls Spock in, I think that's when it decides it's him. But I think before that, it had a different plan in mind, right? And that's something that I see with AI, that AI can do, you know, predictive things. It can kind of know its audience a little bit. And that's, again, why I think we need to be quite aware of our interactions. Like, I have a friend who has a friend who was talking to me recently about a friend of hers who uses AI to respond to even just the most general text messages and conversations with other people at this point, right? And so talking about kind of like waxy and having extra fingers and stuff like that, I think the Spock we get in this holodeck program is very uncanny. And once Lon detects that uncanniness becomes like unreal. Like, you're like, oh my goodness, this isn't him. And so, yeah, if you watching this a second time, you getting to see that uncanniness play out a little bit more directly. I want to watch this episode again. I want to see that portrayed a little more kind of bonk on the head ish as we kind of get forward.
Absolutely. And it's funny and subtle, but really well done. And I think that's good writing. That's good direction. All of that, which, you know, you need for a good murder mystery plot as well. So I think Jonathan Frakes really got to stretch himself here for as silly and whatever as it looks. Like, there's a lot of his craft that goes into this that is brilliant to watch play out.
And so back into kind of commentary, like, we want to talk about how the holodeck kind of comes out of the gate being wildly problematic, I guess you could say.
Yeah. I love that, like, this episode kind of gets away with using all of these tropes again because it's the first time.
Yeah.
Which is like it kind of, you get to the Next Generation, and by season 7, you know, they're trapped in the holodeck again and all this stuff is happening, and you're like, how are they still using this? Like, this doesn't make any sense. This is almost the first episode where these tropes all make sense because they're pushing it to its limits. They're trying to see what it can do. They're trying to find the rough spots to work them out. And yeah, we get the holodeck safeties go offline. We get the, you're trapped in the holodeck. We get the, you can't communicate in and out of the holodeck, all of these things. But because they all crop up, they're recommending that, nope, we'll shelve this technology. It's not good for use on starships. I'm sure they'll bring it back in about 100 years and they'll have ironed out all the bugs by then. What are the engineers at Starfleet doing in this time? Like, they just like, oh, here's this old technology. Let's bring it back. And there's this report appended to it. Whatever. Don't ignore that. It's
right.
Fine.
Right. And yeah, I guess like maybe that again has a lot to say about our relationship to technology as recreation, that getting trapped in it is something that can always happen. I mean, I think about back when you and I were playing video games as kids, right? People were like, oh, it's going to ruin your life. It's going to dominate your attention. And it did. I had a friend who didn't complete high school because he got stuck playing Chrono Trigger on the Super Nintendo. Like,
wow.
And that's all he did. Like, that's all he did. And I mean, much love to him. I doubt he listens to this podcast. And I mean, he would eventually get his education and get things figured out. But I mean, getting trapped in the technology that we have as recreation is not a new thing. And Star Trek has been talking about this for a very long time. What I like about this is they're now really kind of pulling in wordage that we use around artificial intelligence. Now, I forget. I think they said like inputs or something.
The prompt. Yeah. Which is funny because that's what Geordi was giving the holodeck in Elementary Dear Data, right?
Exactly.
A prompt. And they mention AI and a bunch of stuff in this episode and couching it in the language of that we use today. I think that was very clever.
Yeah. You know? It was a wise decision. And I think it also does a fantastic job, again, as Star Trek will, to mirror how we use technology today and give us that ability to kind of think a little bit about how we use technology as either a tool or a crutch, and how much it can become a trap if we're not careful. And we can get stuck in this artificial realm, right? What I'm hopeful for, to some degree, is maybe Strange New Worlds has what it takes to kind of approach social media in the future as well. I mean, I think they've taken a really strong dive at artificial intelligence, but like maybe using the holodeck as a medium for social media, right? Mm-hmm. As a medium for maybe talking to someone far away, right? Like I've often, in my own head canon in Star Trek stories I've created for myself, you know, imagine having a board meeting with a bunch of people who aren't on the same starship, but you go into the holodeck and sit at a desk next to a person who's being projected, right?
Yeah.
Through a subspace transmission.
Yeah, there's a great crossover series of novels, Star Trek Gateways, and it uses the Iconian Gateways as this crisis. And all of the 24th century books basically start with the same scene, which is that, like, holographic conference room where there's the crew of TNG and DS9 and all of these, and the admirals are giving them their briefing and stuff. It was good. I like that. Mm-hmm.
And I mean, that could also have its effects in other ways. Like imagine people who are in long distance relationships getting to actually be quote unquote face to face, right? Like where's the line? So yeah, again, really, really cool. But I don't think that's everything about sort of the details of the holodeck, is it? There's some other kind of fun facts.
Well, there's one last thing I wanted to bring up with the holodeck, and that's what I feel might be a little bit of a nod to Star Trek Voyager, because they did this thing in, I think, the second episode where they're cut off from the Federation, they're far from home, they have energy problems and food rationing problems, but they still want to have their holodeck episodes, right? So they talk about using the energy for the holodeck to power the ship, and they're like, oh, we can't do that. It's a totally separated, isolated system and incompatible, right? Which was silly. It's like, that sounds silly. Why? We just want to have our holodeck episodes. But in this episode, Scotty says, oh, we don't have to shelve the project. He just, he recommends a dedicated server room for the holodeck and have it isolated from the rest of the ship system so it doesn't affect them. And I'm like, wait a minute.
Hold
that
on.
That actually, based on what happened in this episode, that actually kind of makes sense. And like retroactively made that thing in Voyager kind of make a bit more sense. So nice little nod to Voyager and kind of cleaning up a little weird bit of their continuity, I think.
You know, I'm a bit of a broken record, but in this, the writers really do show how much they are drawing from source material, how much homework they're doing on Star Trek itself, and how very much it's apparent to me that we've got some fans writing for Star Trek right now, because to pick those little pieces out, you've got to actually like what you're talking about. And it's funny how the actors portrayed in the Last Frontier, you can tell they don't care about Star Trek. You can tell they don't really care. And even the writers, you know, the writer T.K. Bellows himself doesn't really care. He cares about making money. He cares about his credits. He cares about those things. And so, you know, that's kind of where I want to land here before we get into kind of the final pieces here of Star Trek comes from selling color television and, you know, that kind of hollow jackassy aspect of 1960s Hollywood, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And yeah, that was something I wanted to bring up for sure, was we get the various aspects of Star Trek, and like Gene Roddenberry was a progressive. He had a lot of ideas and a lot of great ideas that went into Star Trek, but he was selling a television show. He was writing and creating a show to make money. Not a bad thing. That's how you get by in the society we've set up, right? The fact that it launched this franchise, which again still exists to make money, that is why Star Trek exists. We have to just like accept that, right? But in this episode, Celia Rose Gooding's character, you get a glimpse of what that inspired. So, you know, I think later in his life, Gene Roddenberry very much became that idealist, right? That head in the clouds, that we would say the you know, no longer the dollar signs necessarily in his eyes, but the stars in his eyes, right? Mm-hmm. Where he very much was like, oh, this I'm embracing this Star Trek as a model for the future thing and becoming a futurist and stuff. And the start of it was the passionate fans in the 1960s who, you know, wrote millions of letters to stop it getting canceled the one time and millions of letters that couldn't stop it getting canceled the next time. Right. Mm-hmm. These people that then went on to pass this legacy on to future generations of this idealism of Star Trek. And this episode I mentioned earlier, it rides this knife's edge. And it tells both sides of that story in very subtle and very cool ways, I think. So,
yeah,
ultimately love letter to Star Trek in my eyes.
Easily. And it's a nuanced love letter, mm-hmm. in that way, because I think by being irreverent, by having these, you know, these shallow characters doing shallow things and whatnot, it sort of shows that an idealistic vision doesn't always come from, you know, pure intentions. Sometimes it's going to have its lumps and its bumps and its scars and all of these sorts of things. But, you know, I've been critical of the writers of recent newer Trek and stuff like that. This really turned me around in a lot of ways because I really felt like I got a love letter from them as well because of the mm-hmm. time they took. Like, they wrote this, right? There's even some internal conversation about being a writer, but I think I got from them a help, we're trapped in the writing room kind of feel from this episode. And I really feel like they were kind of semi-breaching the wall, you know, kind of like in Interstellar, you see those kind of translucent fingers move through. I'm sorry, I'm using a very oblique reference here, but I really do feel like we were spoken to by the writers in this, shall I just say, kind of simply.
Yeah, absolutely. And the one little bit that, like, is more of a silly thing, but I always clock when writers are talking about writers in their yes. writing as well. And my favorite line by TK Bellows, so I'm a writer, I'm never happy about anything.
Right. And that's what I'm getting at is they're constantly up against the bottom line. Like you say, mm-hmm. this is to make money. And I mean, the reason why we're getting these truncated seasons with tinier, you know, episode arcs, with the way streaming has changed the way we watch television and stuff like that, you know, the writers are having to be at the front line of all of this. I'm not trying to say, like, oh, pity the poor writers. Like, they're making the money and they can take it in any direction they really want to. But in this, I see the writers actually trying to kind of reach out to us a little bit and say, like, hey, we're doing our best. We're doing what we can. Here's a love letter to the Star Trek fandom from fans of Star Trek. And that's really turned me around, I guess, is basically what I can say about all this is, mm-hmm. You know, I've had my skepticism. I feel like there's been some herky jerky starts to this new iteration of Trek. I worry to some degree that we're heading into a bit of a twilight period of Star Trek to some degree, just due to the fact that it's not making the money that it's supposed to. And no amount of letters and independent fan based media will keep it going because we're just not a big enough population and we're not rich. So, you know, it's not going to happen. But I feel like episodes like this really do make a fan like me feel seen, I guess. And yeah. I think that's why I enjoyed this episode so much.
Yeah, definitely. And like I was alluding to at the beginning, I worry about a certain segment of fandom that in my head might turn it off after the first 10 minutes and be like, this is making fun of something I love and how dare you, and this is not my father's Star Trek, blah, I'm done. Watch this episode to the end. Like, it really starts out with what you might interpret like that, but by the end it is absolutely a love letter to Star Trek for sure. Mm-hmm.
It's up there with Galaxy Quest for me. Yeah. In terms of irreverent takes on the franchise I love. No. And I'll die on that hill. It was well put together. This episode was a masterpiece.
Well, should we end with our little take out the dead round, a little bits of minutia from the episode?
Yeah. What do you got for me, Dan?
Well, so first of all, the quasar visuals at the start of the episode, I think were gorgeous.
Mm-hmm.
And they follow directly on from the opening credits to The Last Frontier. So I think they just like, let's put a little extra zhuzh on this to make it like, this is what 21st century graphics look like.
Yeah. Yeah.
We get an official crew complement of the Enterprise is 203, which, is less than half of what it is during Kirk's era. So a little bit of an explanation as to why Pike gets those huge quarters, I guess.
I suppose. Yeah. And I mean, you know, we've talked a bit about the busy hallways and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. I feel like this iteration of the Enterprise does have some suitably busy hallways. I would say like next generation level busyness, mm-hmm. but you know, not that same bustle that we get in the 1960s TOS.
Yeah. Did you ever see somebody did a video on like the volume of the Enterprise D and the number of people in it? And they basically were saying like, you will probably walk for a couple days before encountering another person. That's how, if you take the entire usable area. Now, of course, most of the quarters are going to be in the saucer section and stuff, but even that, like, it's very sparsely populated.
Well, it would be, yeah, considering the crew complement and then the size of the ship, you're right. That would have been a pretty empty carpeted hallway hotel in space.
Yeah.
But yeah, I like that we get a number now. So anytime we lose a character or something, we can now keep count, everybody.
We can update it.
Yeah.
I wonder if it'll be as inconsistent as Voyager. 150, 143, 147, 100. Like, where are these people? Anyway.
Yeah. I mean, it won't be as inconsistent as the decks on Nemesis, I'm sure. Oh, but
Star Trek and numbers, man, they just have a problem with them.
I don't know why they didn't pick 247 personally, but whatever.
Right?
Yeah. I tell you.
Last little thing. Spock is now canonically related to Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. He says, as my ancestor, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle said, blah, 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 blah. Which, of course, Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country, he has that line, an ancestor of mine maintained that once you eliminate the impossible, whatever remains, however improbable, must be the truth. Mm-hmm. Which was a Sherlock Holmes line, which has been interpreted to say that Sir Arthur Conan Doyle was a member of Spock's ancestry, and now we get it confirmed. Bravo, Strange New Worlds. Thank you for that.
And that explains Spock's photographic memory.
There you go.
Yeah, because Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, interesting fun fact, when I lived in London, I went down to Baker Street and saw the statue of Sherlock Holmes. A friend of mine was like, can you imagine Sherlock Holmes walked these streets? I'm like, I can imagine it. Because I was like, I had to politely explain that there was no actual, and that was an awkward conversation, but hey, it happens. I've been wrong before many times. I've probably been wrong a few times in this episode, so it's all good.
Illusion shattered.
Smash. Yeah, but the cool part is Sir Arthur Conan Doyle actually, when you know Sherlock and Watson are running through the streets of London, he's actually using his photographic memory of Edinburgh, where he was originally from. And you can actually follow whatever streets still remain. Obviously, Edinburgh has been, you know, rebuilt in certain spots and spaces that you can't actually fully do it anymore. Mm-hmm. But yeah, you can actually go from place to place as Holmes and Watson are going from place to place, but you have to go to Edinburgh to actually do it.
That's fun.
And yeah, similar thing with James Joyce and Dubliners. When he was in Switzerland writing that, people will actually read Bloomsday in that book and actually walk the streets of Dublin with a novel and literally follow where they're going. And that actually, dear listener and dear viewer, don't do that, because muggers in Dublin will see people looking at novels and traveling the streets and they'll go, oh, it was a foreigner, I'm going to get him. So don't actually do that. It's a recipe for getting mugged.
Oh, fun. Yeah. Well, for the full tourist experience, maybe you want to.
yeah, exactly. So yeah, I would just end off. I don't really have too many like total bits and bobs. I think I kind of mentioned some of the minutiae that I enjoyed about the set design, the 1960s/50s set design that existed. But no, I think just what this, what this episode does is it kind of unties the tie and gets a little casual. But what I really love in the end is, as we're joking, as we're kind of having this fun, I feel the lean in of being like, we love you. Mm-hmm. We really, really love you. And that's the feel, that's the feel good aspect of all of this. And it literally ends with a kiss. What a great episode.
Absolutely.
So I think that's pretty much all we have to say about that. I guess channeling another fictional 1960s character, Forrest Gump. But we can keep this conversation going. And I am a little bit more on Facebook, and I have actually done some liking on our Positively Trek discussion group. So
I've noticed that.
It's like a Bigfoot sighting. definitely, folks, pop on there. I don't know how much longer I'm going to keep my Facebook profile, but I may create just a Star Trek-centric Facebook profile specifically for the discussion group. I find Facebook insufferable, but in a sense of the way I find the holodeck problematic too. So there's actually quite a lot of connections there. So definitely check us out on our discussion page. You can also contact us via Gmail as well. But just like this episode, all we have to say is stay positive, folks.
Positively Trek is produced and edited by me, Dan Gunther, and co-produced by Barry DeFord on Treaty 8 territory, the home of the Beaver, Cree, Dene, and Métis people, whose histories, languages, and cultures we respect. We acknowledge the many First Nations, Métis, and Inuit who have lived in and cared for these lands for generations.
Warning, the following ZipRecruiter radio spot you are about to hear is going to be filled with F-words.
When you're hiring, we at ZipRecruiter know you can feel frustrated, forlorn even, like your efforts are futile, and you can spend a fortune trying to find fabulous people, only to get flooded with candidates who are just fine. Fortunately, ZipRecruiter figured out how to fix all that. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. With ZipRecruiter, you can forget your frustrations because we find the right people for your roles fast, which is our absolute favorite F word. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day.
Fantastic.
So whether you need to hire 4, 40, or 400 people, get ready to meet first-rate talent. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/zip to try ZipRecruiter for free. Don't forget, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. Finally, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip.